Hello. So I wanted to start with thanking organizers for inviting me to participate in this. This has really been pretty exciting conference. So I have to confess, reading the sort of the description of this conference and the workshop, I was really pretty conflicted at what to talk about, because exotic, it was, the description was exotic, quantum, non-boson order and non-bosonic systems. Well, everything I do is pretty non-exotic, and most of it is classical. So I had to really try to decide what to talk about. So I decided I'm not gonna. Also, following Jim, I couldn't really talk about bilayers, just because it's difficult to compete with such beautiful talk and such nice data. So I decided I'm going to talk about something completely different. But still, I hope we'll have some relevance to. Remote relevance to sort of the theme of the conference of exotic order. The order is not quite exotic, but there's some messages that I hope to describe in the first part of the talk, which I hope will have some relevance, and I'll hope to make relevant. So the talk will basically break up into two parts. One, it will be some commentary on sort of my view of some of class of systems that exhibit interesting phases, which you can really call critical phases. And the second part of it, so this is sort of probably the most in line with the, although it's, it will be classical, the examples will be classical, most in line with the, sort of the theme of the conference. But sort of to illustrate the, with a concrete model, the examples, or with a concrete physical system, the example I'll describe will be sort of the recent example that we discovered that exhibits this interesting behavior. And this work was done with my student Xing, who is a postdoc now with Paul Goldbart in Urbana. But the sort of the initial work of trying to understand these systems and learn about them was done with Xing and Tom Lubensky and Ranjan Mukhopadhyay. Let me start again with some further apologies or sort of explanation why here am I discussing things classical systems. One is sort of the obvious one that everybody's familiar with. There's definitely very strong connections between and fruitful connections between classical statistical mechanics on one hand and quantum field theory on the other hand. Sort of these connections on one hand is through the transfer matrix formulation of statistical mechanics, and the other hand is the path integral formulation in quantum field theory. Some of the interesting examples that we've learned about where these connections have been very fruitful is I list here. So one example is, of course, two-dimensional crystals, or more generally XY models in two dimensions, classical systems. They have very strong, their phenomenology, or at least the mathematics, is very closely related to sort of one-dimensional Langevin liquids, quantum mechanical one-dimensional systems. The other example that I really like and I spend a lot of time thinking about is symmetric liquid crystals. They have some very strong mathematical connections to thinking about superconductors and even things like the Higgs mechanism. So you can think of this symmetric in some sense as a Higgs phase of a liquid crystal, pneumatic liquid crystal. Of course, other connections, so more recent connections are the, many of you are familiar with the sliding phases in the DNA ionic complexes studied here by Sierra Safinia, then led to some of the very beautiful work on quantum realization of these systems, quantum versions of these systems as a realization of high dimensional Langevin liquid behavior, where you couple one-dimensional Langevin liquid. Well, in the classical system, you have sort of coupled XY models, but the coupling is such that you can actually make the sort of the phase locking, the cosine of the relative phase between the two XY models and the two planes irrelevant. And that corresponds to, in the quantum language, of coupling one-dimensional Langevin liquids into a plane and nevertheless still retaining all the beautiful power law physics of the Langevin liquid, but now in high dimension. Also, again, very closely in line with the, with at least some of the aspects of this conference and workshop, and namely the fractionalization, I can't resist but to mention that sort of the there's a very beautiful realization of Z2 gauge theory in classical systems, namely the isotropic pneumatic transition that was studied by Dan Rockshaw, Lambert, and John Toner, where these ideas, where essentially you get an isotropic phase of a pneumatic liquid crystal, which you know is in direct correspondence with, is really, if interpreted quantum mechanically, is a one of these fractionalized insulator-like states, where, and there you really can't say, so what happens really is in the pneumatic system you have you have two types of defects. You have hedgehog defects and you have charge half disclinations or charge half vortices. And by controlling the chemical potential for these two type of defects, you can access phases, and there's some now experimental evidence for this. You can access some phases where charge half disclinations do not unbind, and therefore have a continuous transition between the isotropic phase and the into between a pneumatic state into a funny isotropic phase where these half disclinations are not unbound. So in that, you know, that definitely has very strong overlaps with some of these fractionalization ideas that you've heard about. But let me now closer to what I want to talk about. Let me start out with, you know, somewhat maybe a provocative statement is that about fluctuations and nonlinearities in phase transitions. And basically what I want to say is that most of you, I hope, would agree is that sort of the upshot of 40 years of research in fluctuations in critical phenomena, you know, taught us that in most systems, usually fluctuations and nonlinearities are really only important near isolated points, critical points, where, you know, it's a point between, they describe a continuous phase transition between an ordered and disordered phase. And so, you know, in order to exhibit this sort of, in order to have nonlinearities and fluctuations to be important, you really have to fine-tune at least one parameter to get to this kind of a point. Okay, so in a sort of a cartoonish way, you can have in the back of your mind some kind of a ferromagnet, and in order for, and it's described by some Phi-4 theory with some gradient terms, some quadratic term, and some quartic term, which is this is the nonlinearity, and in order to make this nonlinearity have any effect at long scales, you really need to, by hand, tune the quadratic term that's sort of the mass term or the reduced temperature in order to activate the, have this quartic term to be actually important. If you're aware, as you all know, if you have some finite value of the reduced temperature, then immediately if it's positive, you flow off to a positive, infinite positive temperature, you just describe by some S squared, Hamiltonian is just simply S squared, all the excitations are massive. Or if you're at a negative reduced temperature, you flow off to some ordered phase, which is also, in most cases, I'm not saying, I mean, part of the sort of the interest, part of the questions I discuss here is how you can deviate from this behavior, but most of the time, the ordered phases are also pretty boring. Even when they have Goldstone modes, these Goldstone modes are weakly interacting, and they're pretty much described by sort of a free field theory. Okay. Of course, there are well-known exceptions, are things like quantum Hall effect, but the general paradigm sort of fits into this picture. That the interesting interplay between nonlinearities and fluctuations that are single near in the vicinity of a critical point, but the phases themselves are pretty boring. Okay, and Matthew's already making a commentary because he. Part of the focus is try to understand how this is not, you know, find systems where this is not true. But I think in most conventional systems, this is really the case. And what I want to discuss, tell you about systems which are, in all respects, pretty conventional, but, you know, when put in this language, they actually have a very different phenomenology. Okay. And so I call these systems critical phases. These systems that I'll discuss exhibit so-called critical phases, namely, the picture of the three normalization group flow or the phase diagram is very different. When you're above the transition temperature, so generally these systems will also exhibit some phase transition between a disordered phase and an ordered phase. And And that transition could even be a first order, so that's not really important for what I'm going to focus on, which will be the ordered phase. But the point is, if that transition is continuous, there are, of course, interesting nonlinearities and fluctuations at the critical point. And if you're above that critical point, you flow to a disordered phase, which is fairly conventional and, in most cases, boring. Certainly in these systems, it's pretty conventional, pretty boring. On the other hand, if you're below this critical point, what happens is you begin to flow to sort of low temperatures or low value of the coupling constant, but you don't flow all the way to the zero coupling constant or zero temperature fixed point. But instead, that zero temperature fixed point is actually unstable, itself unstable. And the actual full phase, the whole phase, is described by a non-trivial ordered phase attractive, infrared attractive fixed point. So in a cartoonish kind of a way, what you should have in your mind is that the phase, rather than being described by some grad phi squared or just phi squared, the ordered phase, it's described by, it's sort of by hand all inside this phase, phi to the 4 term. You've shut off the phi squared term and phi to the 4 term remains important all throughout this phase. Unlike, you know, to be contrasted with a critical, being near a critical point where you really have to fine tune at least one parameter to have fluctuations and linearities to be simultaneously important. So here, this will be enforced by some symmetry, very interesting symmetries of these phases, pretty simple symmetries. And so then you can really, with very conventional, well, okay, so immediately you can say that the properties of this phase will be, you know, exotic, at least in the sense that all throughout the phase, without any fine-tuning, they will exhibit behavior, phenomenology, which is quite, you know, which will be very similar to, and do exhibit phenomenology, which is similar to the kind of phenomenology you see near a critical point. And again, you know, let me go on and I'll say that in the context of a couple of next slides. So it turns out that, you know, it wasn't by intention, but if I sort of thought back about the kind of systems I've been working on for the past 10 to 15 years, going even back to graduate school, somehow a theme developed that on and off I've worked on systems that in fact fall into this class, and hence I decided to sort of give a somewhat overviewish talk about, you know, how these systems really fit into this class. And this is somehow has never been strongly enough emphasized, that there's this class of systems, mostly the ones I'm familiar with in soft condensed matter physics, that are exhibit these critical phases. And so I've listed here some of the examples. Let me discuss in sort of in this introductory comments in most detail the smectic phase, which is a phase of liquid crystals where you get a one-dimensional layered order. The molecules, and I'll discuss this in a little bit more detail later, but just for the introductory remarks, you basically, liquid crystal molecules, which are these elongated hydrocarbon molecules, are organized into layered structure. Okay, one-dimensional layer structure. And the upshot of it is, and I'll describe a little bit how this comes about, but let me first say what happens is that when you go into this smectic phase, this one-dimensional layered phase, the whole phase, the phase is described by a Goldstone mode, U, which is basically the one-dimensional scale of phonon that describes these layer undulations. And as promised in this cartoonish way in the previous slide, the elastic theory of that phase, of this Goldstone mode, is actually, well, has this form. It has it has some gradient-like terms or Laplacian-like terms in the transverse direction. It has z as the layer normal. It has some compression. So this is a bending term of the layers. That's why it's a second derivative. This is a compressional term. Energy cost, elastic energy cost for compressing the layers. And if you stopped right there, this would be sort of the analog, although highly anisotropic analog of an XY model. However, because this term is so soft, meaning it comes in as a Laplacian rather than just a simple gradient, it turns out that the nonlinearities, elastic nonlinearities that are always there in any crystal, any solid medium, and are usually unimportant, completely unimportant, long length scales, these nonlinearities turn out to be just as important as all the quadratic terms in the system, okay, in this Hamiltonian. So if you imagine expanding this complete square, you'll get things that are just harmonic, and then there'll be some cubic terms in U and quartic terms in U. And one thing you will notice is there will not be a term that's quadratic in grad u. So that's the analogy of, if you think of grad u as phi, okay, there's a term, grad phi, grad u, which is phi, phi squared is missing in this theory, in this elastic energy, okay? And it's missing for a very, you know, simple reason of rotational invariance, and it simply has to do with the fact that if I take all the layers and I rotate the layers and the molecules by some angle, that rotation just corresponds to a finite gradient of u. And since the system is a rotational invariant system, there cannot be any energy cost associated with the gradient of u of the rotation, simultaneous rotation of the layers and the directors. Okay, as a result, the symmetry, rotational invariant, and this partial spatial breaking of this translational symmetry enforces the absence of the gradient of u term. And that's really all, in all these systems I'll describe, this is what's at the heart of being able to get a phase, an ordered phase, which is actually critical. The fact that the symmetry enforces some mass term to be to vanish. And the way this comes about, and I just sort of, to entertain you, goes back to sort of ideas of Degen, who noticed that the theory of the symmetric phase and the transition into it is actually very, you know, isomorphic to a superconductor. So you can associate the director, which is the orientation of these little molecules, with a gauge. You can think of it as a gauge field. So N is like the gauge field, and U is like the phase of a superconducting phase of the superconducting order parameter. So this looks like a gradient of the phase minus the vector potential squared, plus another gradient of the phase, and then this is the sort of the Maxwell term. So one thing you might notice is because orientation of the director is actually a physical degree of freedom. that will happen, I guess, once in a while. There are terms that actually break gauge invariance, that sort of gauge fixing like terms, because there's not really a gauge invariance. All this, the reason this grad u and delta n have to come in this combination, it really comes from rotational invariance, and it's actually a global rotational invariance, not a local rotational invariance. So in fact, you know, you can write down terms that are higher, the curvature terms that do not have to come into this minimal coupling combination. But still, if you look at this system and you know, look at what the low energy degrees of freedom are, you actually have a Higgs mechanism going on. And here there's a very simple physical interpretation of the Higgs mechanism. It's just the so-called gauge field of this director fluctuation get frozen, you know, get frozen or get locked to the layer undulations. So there's a massive mode which corresponds to the director fluctuations fluctuating away from the layer normal, which is described by the gradient of u. So this is a massive mode. So when you get a combination like this, so what the system does at low energies, it fluctuates in such a way that the layers and the director fluctuate together, such that this term is exactly zero. As soon as this term is zero, you immediately lose B perp coupling, right? Because if you're in the manifold where B perp is large, now all the fluctuations are described by simply this term is minimized, which is you lose this coupling. So as a result, if you just simply take delta n and set it to the grad u and minimize and insert it into here, what you get is a Laplacian. So this divergence of n is nothing more than the delta n being the grad of u. So you get a second derivative, which is just the curvature term. So the only penalties for the for fluctuation of the symmetric is the curvature term plus the compression. Now these nonlinear terms, it's a little bit more subtle, but it's still pretty simple. The nonlinear terms arise from the fact that there's two levels at which the rotational invariance comes in. On one hand, it comes in this way I already described, at the harmonic level. So at the harmonic level, the rotational invariance of the symmetric layers just means that there's no gradient of u terms, gradient of u squared. At a nonlinear level, it also has its effect. And as soon as this, you realize there's no gradient of u, then you have to think about nonlinear terms. And the nonlinear terms come in simply because if you rotate your layers, so imagine in a situation where I rotate the symmetrics and I rotate the whole symmetric. Now along the original z-axis, the layers effectively look like they've been stretched. Okay. So, but I know that should not cost any energy. So if I really just had du dz squared, that would cost some energy, at least at nonlinear level. Okay? So what this term does is effectively compensates us for this and compensates this apparent stretching of the layers by the fact that if that the layer rotation or the angle squared exactly can compensate this apparent stretching of the layers, as long as you keep the perpendicular distance between the layers fixed, and that will cost no energy. So again, so there are two ingredients, sort of the harmonic expression of rotational invariance and the nonlinear. And because at the harmonic level you have rotational invariance and the softer derivatives, the nonlinear terms have become important. That's really the message. So there's these many other systems. Okay, so the other thing I was going to mention is that as soon as this Higgs mechanism takes place, so for example, the expulsion, the analog of expulsion of the flux is the fact that the twisting of the director gets expelled. You cannot twist symmetric layers. On the other hand, the splay of the directors, meaning when the directors go fan out, just corresponds to bending of the symmetric layers, and that's still a finite energy excitation. So there are many other systems like the columnar phases where you form columns that have this similar phenomena. This is the columnar phase, and so now you have a bunch of disks forming columnar phase, so now you will be a vector, two-dimensional vector, which is the displacement of these columns. And there's also a rotational invariance, because you can take all the columns and simultaneously rotate them. That's a Goldstone mode of the system. That there should not be any energy associated with it. And so there's a very analogous but more complicated tensor like elastic energy, in which nonlinear terms are important. And that phase system also goes into this exhibits these critical phases. Now, finally, the other system that I just want to mention that I spent a lot of time working on were tensionless polymerized membranes. So we have a membrane fluctuating. Overall rotational invariance of the membrane in the embedding space also exhibits these kind of phases. So let me now again summarize what I said, or at least summarize the properties of these critical phases. So first, you always have, at least in the examples that I've seen, you always have some broken continuous spatial symmetry. Okay, the phases you get, the order phases you get, as I've already mentioned, are described by a non-trivial fixed point at which Goldstone modes are really actually strongly interacting. At this fixed point, the phase is really described by at this fixed point, the effects of fluctuations, elastic nonlinearities, and harmonic terms are all exactly balanced in such a way that you get power law power law correlations. So this leads to, again, universal power law correlation functions, and furthermore, amplitude ratios, much like you do at you find at a critical point. And what's amazing is you need no fine-tuning to get to this critical behavior. So it seems to be, at least, you know, if you could find some quantum analogs quantum analog generalizations of this kind of behavior, these two points seem to be pretty appealing if your goal is try to motivated by understanding high-temperature superconductors or correlated systems in general, where part of the story was to try to understand these anomalous behavior of correlated systems by finding phases that exhibit deviation from sort of standard Fermi liquid behavior. So this is sort of will be the end. If you find quantum systems that behave like this, they would be a good candidate for trying to explain some of the anomalous properties that you see in correlated systems. Why 3D? What do you mean, why 3D?
Skipped over 2D.
Well, 3D or 2D, I mean, well, okay. No,
the model is a 3D.
Doesn't matter. What I mean is if you can find systems that have this kind of a RG flow where the low temperature phase is actually, there's a finite coupling fixed point in the ordered phase, then they would have pretty attractive properties from the point of view of sort of phenomenology that you see in experiments of correlated systems. 2D, 3D. You know, this is hard enough, so I mean, I would be happy to find 2D generalizations of these. So this is the sort of the first part, and that's really that's all the time I'm going to spend on really trying to reach this audience in terms of sort of connections to the main theme of this workshop. And so the rest of the time I want to spend telling you about the latest system that we found that realizes that actually exhibits this kind of a critical phase. Yeah?
Can I ask one technical point just on the previous, with Lagrangian, the other action? Yeah, so, power counting in three spectral dimensions, U is marginal, is my understanding, right?
So that's right. So the
non-linearity dzu grad u squared is a marginal perturbation.
That's right. So this theory in the...
So what do the RG flow equations look like for that coupling?
It's irrelevant. It's marginally irrelevant. So you get logarithmic correlations.
Log corrections,
much like you do at an upper critical dimension. But what's so that's what actually Greenstein and Pelkovitz did. They calculate these universal logarithmic correlations.
But what extent can?
But it
scales to the Gaussian theory then.
So right, exactly in three dimensions. But if you look at it in 3 minus epsilon. In 3 minus epsilon dimensions, it really has a non-trivial fixed point G star of order epsilon. But furthermore, okay, so...
I see, so if you go to...
So for example, so let me...
Defect you're leaving out, probably.
Yeah, so that's... You do need to worry about defects, and... Okay, so let me leave that aside for a second, but let me make the following comment is that if you... John Toner and I have spent quite some time studying what happens if you now introduce quench disorder to the system. So you take this kind of a smectic and put it inside something, some porous environment like aerogel or aerosol. And then it turns out the effects of quench disorder are far stronger than thermal effects of thermal fluctuations. And then the ground state of this kind of a smectic is still elastically stable. So the topological defects are not unbinary. At least we don't have any rigorous proofs of this, but we have some suggestive arguments. And the upper critical dimension shifts from 3 to 5. So now actually in 3 dimensions you have a very strongly anomalous fixed point that describes the ordered phase. So that's one example. The other example of how these systems do have in physical 3-dimensional situations have very exhibit these phases is when you go to dynamics. This model, while in 3 dimensions, while the static model in 3 dimensions is these nonlinears are just marginal, when you look at Langevin-like dynamics of these systems, the upper critical dimension is 5. So you get universal divergence of viscous coefficients in these systems. And this was also beautiful work done by John Toner many years ago with really pretty spectacular agreement with experiments that saw these frequency-dependent viscosities. Shobha Bhattacharya did the experiments at that time. Okay, so that's sort of the attempt to connect to some of the themes of this workshop. But for the rest of it is, you can think of it as a comic relief to fractionalization, quantum mechanics, or a colloquium or something like that. I'm going to talk about systems that are pretty disconnected from what the main theme of this workshop is, and that is one realization of the systems in this class that exhibit these critical phases. So the one ingredient of it that they'll go into building this kind of a system is liquid crystals. So liquid crystals, even for this audience, I don't need to review. It's a really old field of that's over a century old now that continues to bring out many beautiful surprises and many interesting both basic physics questions. Impacting things like critical phenomena, understanding hydrodynamics, coarsening, topological defects, but even as toy models of sort of early universe. Didn't we start late? So the other ingredient is the other ingredient that's going to come into this. The other player is sort of very conventional. Okay, so let me just go back to the phase that I'm going to focus on here, although the exhibit enormous number of phases and very rich behavior. I'm going to focus on the pneumatic phase of these liquid crystals.
What are the length scales on this picture? Pretty picture.
Well, these are just to give you some feeling what these phases exhibit. These are pneumatic between. This is the kind of ordering. This is smectic layering. This. It's all optical images. So the other ingredient is rubber. Okay. So just for the purpose of this talk, all you should think about when you think about sort of conventional rubber, you take a bunch of polymers, a bunch of elastic strings. Cross-link them together, and you get a piece of rubber. Okay, and for the most part, although you know, sort of describing sort of the system is in itself is quite non-trivial. Its macroscopic properties, its elastic properties, are pretty trivial, pretty conventional. In that, they're conventional in the sense that they exhibit standard hooking elasticity. Okay, the only sort of exotic thing about it is that this elasticity arises from entropic effects, and so as a result, the elastic constants at temperature are actually proportional to temperature. So when you heat up these systems, they become actually stiffer. Although I hesitate when I say this because I did a science project with my daughter last year and putting weights on rubber bands and weighing them, and this did not work. But so I'm really, I don't know.
That's related to experimental skin.
Yeah, we did good experiments. We have a lot of data, but. Anyway, so what I want to tell you about is this system called pneumatic elastomer, which is sort of this what I call liquid crystal rubber, where you take these two systems. One is sort of these liquid of orientationally ordered liquid, this pneumatic described by a rank 2 order parameter. Within the phase, you can just think of it as a director, a little vector. And you put it together within this piece of rubber where the polymers now have these. There are various ways of doing it, but the simplest conceptual way to think of it is it's a side chain elastomer where the pneumatogens are sort of hanging off of each of the main polymer backbone. So you can think of this thing as a solid liquid crystal, in the sense that sort of as liquid crystal itself is not an oxymoron already. So you think of it as a solid liquid crystal. Okay. What I want to emphasize here is that liquid crystal order. What you mean by this is its phases. It's partially spontaneously break spatial symmetries. So for the long time, we've always sort of considered, in order to spontaneously partially break spatial symmetry, you need to be in a liquid phase. Okay, because liquid, you start in a liquid phase. It has all the symmetries of spatial transformations. On the other hand, there's another way to have a liquid crystal order, but not in a solid, and that's described here. If your solid is completely disordered, like a piece of rubber, statistically, it's like a liquid in the sense that it's homogeneous and isotropic. I mean, locally there are these heterogeneities, and you have to worry about them, and that's where the disorder comes in. But at least statistically on long scales, it's a homogeneous isotropic medium. So now you are able to actually talk about seriously about spontaneously breaking translational and rotational symmetry in the solid phase. Okay, so you have this two-component system, and it's amazing. People have made, these heroes, Terentyev, Finkelman, and Ratner, independent efforts have been able to make these kind of systems, and they exhibit fairly conventional liquid crystal phases. Even though this is all happening on this piece of rubber background, in the solid, in terms of the optical properties, they exhibit fairly conventional liquid crystal phases. And so you have this, these experimentalists have created these kind of materials in the past 10 years and been spending a lot of time studying them. And so we want to think about these systems. And there's sort of two complementary set of questions that you need to answer and you should be thinking about in order to understand these materials. So on one hand, if you're a liquid crystal person, you might want to ask, what is the effect of polymer matrix, this rubber background, this solid background, on all the liquid crystal properties that we know and love? Okay? And so I spent a lot of time with John Toner, and there's been a lot of other work, particularly a lot of interesting experimental work by Clark, Garland, and Bergeneau, studying what in fact happens when you impose some prescribed, rigid, random background onto a liquid crystal order. So, and particularly it's been studied not in these elastomers, but in the related system, at least, that only has this aspect of the problem, and that is by taking liquid crystal and putting in some random medium. So there's no question of what the random medium does, because the random medium is frozen, And then you're only asking about the liquid crystal, what the liquid crystal is doing. On the other hand, if you're a polymer physicist, you might want to ask, how does the ordering of the liquid crystal modify the elastic properties? And so here, and there's been a lot of work on that in the past 10 years since the discovery of these materials, synthesis of these materials. And in order to understand these materials, we really have to understand self-consistently both of these questions. But I'm going to just mostly focus on this question, the second question. So let me tell you about two sort of the main, most striking experiments that show how novel these materials are. Okay, so the first one is the one on the left. You start out, it's a force extension curve. The first one is basically a spontaneous extension of this piece of rubber as a function of temperature. So when you start out in a high temperature phase, this piece of rubber is essentially isotropic liquid crystal, so it has isotropic elasticity, and it's described by just Hooke's law. Okay. On the other hand, when you lower the temperature past the transition where the liquid crystals, the pneumatogens, order into a pneumatic state, you get a spontaneous distortion, uniaxial distortion, where the polymers now, their random walks are now biased along the in a uniaxial way by the pneumatic ordering. And you get a spontaneous distortion that can be in experiments as large as 400% by changing, you know, the temperature by only, 10 degrees or something like that. So it's really a spectacular effect. And, you know, people have discussed things like, thinking about applications to plastic display switches, actuators, and even artificial muscle, which is what Ratna at NRL is thinking about.
Eventually, where did they break? This is absolutely fascinating, this thing. I mean, eventually they break somehow, right? I mean, it will reach the plastic limit.
No, what do you mean? No, it does not break. It's just all these chains, you should really think of them, they're really loose. It's not like bonds in the crystal. It's all entropy. And so now they're just the way you minimize entropy is by walking in a particular direction more than in the transverse direction.
Are there any that do this at room temperature?
There's one at 10,000. No. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, this is 100 Celsius. This is not in Kelvin.
It's long room temperature. 200 to 400.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is exotic. So, yeah. The other really beautiful and striking experiment is to look at the force extension curves. So along the director, once you're in this phase, in this pneumatic elastomer phase, along the uniaxial axis, it looks pretty Hookean. The elasticity is pretty Hookean. But perpendicular to it, look at this bottom curve, it exhibits this enormous plateau of a stress as a function of strain. And so to put it in perspective, this is sort of like, for a whole range of stress, if you pull perpendicular to the uniaxial direction, there's no stress for a whole range of strain. Okay. So if you want to put it upside, if you want to put this curve vertical, rotated by 90 degrees, and think of the lower axis as the current and the upper axis as the voltage, you can think of it as like a Josephson effect. This is like the IV curve where there's a very amazingly, response of the strain to stress. If you weren't applying a stress to and see what strain you induce. Basically, infinite differential conductivity here.
And the different curves are what?
This is a different, they do it at different strain rates to study sort of the dynamics. Yeah. And this is sort of the asymptotic curve at asymptotic zero strain rate. Okay. So what's going on? So there's been a lot of work from the point of very microscopic, very model specific point of view, but still a lot of progress has been made by Mark Warner at Oxford. No, okay, I've forgotten where he is. Either Oxford or Cambridge, one or the other. But we wanted to develop a description of this phenomena in terms of sort of general elasticity theory, where it doesn't depend on any some specific microscopic models of polymers. Just understand it in terms of some symmetry breaking phenomena. Okay, and so in fact, you can do this in very simple ways, and hopefully the analogy with smectics will be helpful. So in an isotropic phase, the elasticity is very simple because there's basically no isotropic order, and so then you just have a standard Hookean elasticity with some elastic moduli. On the other hand, the way you understand the transition, this tensor order parameter Q can couple to this train. The orientation order parameter Q can couple to the strain of the solid. And so when Q begins to order, what happens is, as a function of temperature, when Q orders, basically U follows it. You can think of it as Q as the field that U follows. Okay? And in the order, so to understand the ordered phase, the pneumatic elastomer phase, you can just, at least as a cartoon thing, you can try to complete this square. And so now you have some elastic energy for orientational distortions and some energy that has that's just a difference between the elastic distortion and the orientational distortion. And what you and from this form you can very clearly see where this that this phenomenon, this plateau, is basically a manifestation of a Goldstone mode. A Goldstone mode that involves a simultaneous rotation of the director and the uniaxial distortion. Okay? So to make it that more concrete, just think about making a distortion UZI, which means you distort a solid in the transverse direction to this uniaxial spontaneous distortion. Well, as long as the Q can follow, the reorientation of the director can follow, that will cost no energy, just like in the smectic, because this term is still minimized and you have a zero energy. Okay? You, of course, will be able to continue that until you orient all the way at 90 degrees, so that distortion will only continue up to some critical value, which is characterized by how uniaxially distorted it is, spontaneously uniaxially distorted it is. And after that, you'll get seemingly just the hooking elasticity. And so, yeah, so this behavior, this cartoon, is sort of is supposed to be the idealization of the experimental plot that I showed here, this plateau. Okay, so how do you describe this now? So let me just very quickly write down. I don't want to do any details. The challenge is to construct a theory, elastic theory, of these Goldstone modes, of this pneumatoelastic mode, about the distorted state. And the reason it's so difficult is because the distorted state is anisotropic, uniaxial, but nevertheless you need to encode, not just at a harmonic level, but at a nonlinear level, the rotational invariance, the underlying rotational invariance. So this is it was pretty challenging, and it was described in these three publications with Sean, and then also there was a work with later work by Tom Lubensky and his postdoc Stenel. And the upshot is that, well, you have to incorporate actually two rotational invariances. In normal solid, there's only a rotational invariance with respect to target space, but in addition, there's also rotational invariance in these isotropic systems, in these amorphous solids. There's also rotational invariance inside the actual internal space, or the reference space. Meaning, I don't have a rubber band here, but I should have. Let me leave that. So basically, you can, at the harmonic level, what that implies is this rotational invariance, these two rotational invariants imply, is that when you write down an elastic theory for this uniaxial solid, which has a UZZ distortions, in-plane distortions, shear distortions, bulk distortions, and the coupling between strain tensor UZZ and UII, the shear modulus UZI is actually vanishes identically. Okay. What time did I start? With questions.
Which questions do you want to finish by 11:35?
Okay, I'll be okay. Yeah, it'll be fine. So at a harmonic level, what this rotational invariance implies is that a shear modulus, one of the five shear moduli of a usual uniaxial solid, is actually identically vanishes. And that's the analog of the smectic not having this grad U square term identically. And that's, again, what's going to be at the heart of this vanishing of the mass all throughout the phase that's enforced by this rotational invariance. Once you realize that this guy vanishes identically, you have to think about nonlinear terms. Because you can show the nonlinear terms, elastic nonlinears are important. And biggest challenge was to actually construct a nonlinear theory, sort of the generalization of this, which sort of looks identical, but the strain tensor actually have nonlinear pieces in them that respect this rotational invariance at nonlinear order. And so with Sean, we've been able to actually construct this kind of elastic theory. And here, these nonlinearities, they sort of look like smectic-like nonlinearities and columnar phase-like nonlinearities.
What happened to the director?
The director of, so this is a, I've integrated a director much like I can integrate a director for the smectic. So now the whole description is in terms of this elastic medium. Because the director is now massively coupled to the uniaxial and isotropy of the solid. So once you've constructed that Hamilton, that elastic description of these interacting Goldstones, you then want to study both thermal fluctuations and heterogeneities. So I don't want to get into how do you describe these heterogeneities, but just to tell you that you can now study this nonlinear elastic theory in the presence of these two effects, thermal fluctuations and heterogeneities. And what that does is it indeed, in this ordered phase, the harmonic theory is unstable to these nonlinearities in the presence of heterogeneities and fluctuations, and you flow off to a fixed point, which is, you know, this is a cartoon for some, for a real calculation here, and this is the attractive fixed point in this ordered phase that's caricatured by this T star, which describes this anomalous elastic medium. It's elastic medium in which there's a balance between, at long scales, there's a balance between thermal and disorder fluctuations and harmonic terms and nonlinearities.
We have a small parameter.
If it's a disordered system, it's five minus d, and if it's a thermal system, it's 3 minus d. Okay, depending on what. So let me just conclude with, this is a next to last slide, with just the predictions that come out of it. Okay, just to again return to the previous to the theme of this. To the theme of this conference a little bit. So first of all, there's some length scale beyond which that it takes to cross over from this Gaussian fixed point to this non-trivial fixed point. So you can calculate that length. And beyond that length scale, you get truly universal behavior, much like you do at a critical point. And so for example, if you compute Fournier correlations, most correlations behave in this power law-like way with these exponents that are universal. However, in these systems, you don't really measure correlations. A much more direct measurement is sort of doing elasticity, actually doing stress-strain curves. And so, amazingly, these kind of anomalous correlation functions, power law correlation functions, translate into something much more, you know, much more tangible. You can translate it into stress-strain curves that are actually non-Hookian. So there's some delta parameter, and this delta universal exponent is actually greater than 1.
With disorder in
3 dimensions.
Okay.
Well, with disorder, any dimension less than 5, there will be non-Hookian elasticity. And just to kind of intrigue you a little bit and to make again contact with you, this is as hard to create, and this is as exotic as sort of and destabilizing Hookian elasticity is, in the language of electronic systems, the correlation systems, it's like destabilizing a Fermi liquid. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to find a way to, you know, to have a system not be Hookian. Because, of course, at large strains, everything is eventually non-Hookian. What I'm talking about here is at sufficiently, at arbitrary low strains, the system is non-Hookian. This is sort of the analog of arbitrarily close, you know, you take a electronic Fermi system, and, you know, far enough from Fermi surface, it's non, you know, it might behave in some crossover way, but at sufficiently low energies close to the Fermi surface, it will eventually, most systems, unless you have fractionalization, it will cross over to a Fermi liquid fixed point. So this is as exotic for elasticity theory as the non-Fermi liquid behavior for fermionic systems. You can also translate into elastic constants being length scale dependent. So if you have a finite piece of sheet, these elastic constants actually will depend in a power law way on the size of the system. They're not constants, really. They're really size of the system dependent. And so these systems become macroscopically incompressible. And furthermore, not only is the universal, you get a universal exponent, you also get what's called universal, the analog of universal amplitude ratios, which we call Poisson ratio. So let me just give you an example here. If you take this sheet and you stretch it in the x direction, it will extend in the y direction by exactly 5/7 of the amount that you straighten in the x direction, independent of what material it is. So, and similarly in the z direction, it will come in. With a factor of exactly 12/7 of the strain that you put in the x direction. Okay, completely universal number. Okay, so let me just conclude with what I've told you about. I told you about I've described some systems in that are the only realizations of them I know are in soft condensed matter systems, which exhibit critical phases. So the example I really focused on is the liquid crystal solid, a pneumatic elastomer. And it shows dramatic it's dramatically influenced by thermal fluctuations and heterogeneities, and exhibits sort of really anomalous macroscopic elasticity. So there are many interesting questions remaining: the questions of dynamics, other liquid crystal phases, whether they exhibit this, other liquid crystal rubber phases, are there quantum realization of these kind of critical phases? And there's also things that we've thought about, but still these questions are not definitely answered: the effects of defects. What happens at these points if you now start including defects? And the analysis of defects are very complicated, because in a lot of these systems, there are topological defects, and now the analysis of the relevance or irrelevance of these topological defects has to be done not at some Gaussian fixed point, but really at this strongly interacting low temperature fixed point. Okay, and I'll stop here. Thank you. Sorry for going off.
This is just a question about the quantum realizations of critical phases. I remember that if you have an array of domain walls or stripes or something, I think as Jan Zanin has used the analogy to a sort of lamellar phase, in 2+1 dimensions you have a family of surfaces that are repelling each other. But is it correct that you would be likely to get this kind of phase out of that only to the extent that there was no lattice anisotropy that sort of made it have a preferred direction?
Exactly. So as soon as you have lattice anisotropy, all this goes out the window, because at long enough scales you'll get a gradient of U squared like terms coming in. The only candidate, and that's why it's so hard in a solid state environment to produce something like this. The only examples I can think of is goes back to Jim's kind of experiment, where you're in a semiconductor, then the length scales that are involved, even though in principle there are some anisotropies, the electron density is so low that the length scales are far larger than the lattice scale. So there you see phenomena that can be thought about in terms of stripes, and those stripes really, to very good accuracy, although asymptotically they're still orientationally pinned, have to be orientationally pinned, do have this rotational symmetry. And that's been incorporated into sort of the physics of these quantum Hall symmetric phases that, let's say, Matthew and Alan McDonald has worked on, and others.
I guess we did have a talk a few weeks ago by Christian Fleiter on manganese silicide, where many of these issues came up with the liquid crystal. I mean, there the spin has a spiral order, and there seem to be blue phase-like regions of the crystal. So you don't really have to apologize for presenting this, but it is related to electronic systems too.
The other example that just comes to mind that we worked on with John Toner and the collaborators was magnetic superconductor. So imagine you have it's not clear whether you have a actual physical realization of this system, but imagine you have ignoring lattice effects, you have some maybe a powder sample or something like this. Imagine you have a superconductor in which you have coexistence of ferromagnetism and type 2 superconductivity. So then in principle in that system you can imagine having a phase where without you have a spontaneous vortex lattice, meaning a vortex lattice is brought about not by an external field, which explicitly breaks rotational invariance, but it comes about from the local moments. So in that kind of a lattice, that kind of a vortex lattice, as we worked out, has very different elastic properties, simply because than a conventional vortex lattice, because now the lines are much more floppy, because there's no orientational field, external field, that tells them which way to run. And they behave very similar to these columnar phases, and they do go into this, they do exhibit this critical...
Does that survive cubic crystal anisotropy?
No, it doesn't. That's why I said powder sort of sample.
Yes? Well, I have a question. Maybe Subir can actually answer it better. But the manganese silicide blue phase, am I supposed to understand? No, it's a very good question. I mean, a very good point. That does that in the manganese silicide blue phase, is it really?
They've got a spiral order state.
Right.
And then above these three, there's seems to be spin disorder, like one of the hypotheses that there's some kind of pressure
okay.
Oh, I realized that. I mean, I was just referring to the phase they found, but does that then explain why they see non-Fermi liquid behavior over a range of pressures?
Sorry. Huh? Me? No.
Right,
no.
Right. So, okay, so what John was saying was that if in manganese silicide, this is, I guess, the point I should have made, we have this rather remarkable observation of non-Fermi liquid behavior over an entire phase. So that's very suggestive of the kind of things you're talking about.
Okay, I'm not familiar with
and
it.
And there's also, in that case, you know, at least a well-ordered phase, which is something like a cholesteric crystal with a spiral and a spin order. But then as you apply pressure, you lose the cholesteric order and you go into some phase which seems non-Fermi liquid-like.
From the transport point of view?
Yeah,
okay.
Electrical conductivity is T to the 3 halves. And there's really no understanding of it, and it's in manganese, so the spins are really very classical. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe that the spins have been screened out. So it's right. Possible there's some connection to some of the things you're saying. But that's an interesting open question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, okay, well, any more comments, questions? So let's thank Leo and move on to the next question.